All right, here we go. We're starting the day in earnest. Our first speaker is Jake Harris. He's the VP of Supplier Marketing, Centralized Engineering from Aero Electronics, and he's going to talk to us about the changing global industry dynamics in the market today and in the future. So, Jake, come on up.
Hey, good morning. How are you? So that was pretty awesome. That was probably one of the best kickoffs I've seen in a long time. So thanks to the guys for having me here. So just so you know, so my name is Jake Harris. I've got responsibility today in the Americas for all of our supplier relationships. Aero for about 20 years, and I'm actually from Canada. So at some point today, we'll have an American on stage. I'm not sure at what point that's going to be, but hopefully at some point we'll have an American up here. So what I want to do for the next probably 20 minutes, give or take, is to give you a sense for what we're seeing in the market overall. And we thought that this would be a great way to kind of have a foundation for the day, because we're very much in a very kind of uncertain environment today. So I like to start with kind of the big themes, kind of like what's happening out there in the market overall. And I think you'd have to be living, you know, in a cave to not realize that, you know, we're in a situation of tremendous market uncertainty and kind of geopolitical imbalance. And what that's causing for us, and, you know, from an electronics standpoint, is that we're in actually one of the steepest, if not the, actually it is the steepest downturn that we've seen since 1981 in terms of overall customer consumption, which is actually kind of a crazy thing to say. But it's, I'm not sure how to say it. It's, you know, it's a really interesting environment that we're in between tariffs, geopolitical problems, etc. And we're going to see what's going to happen next little while. Interesting thing for us is that there are tons of really interesting technology advances that are driving our business right now as well. One of my old jobs was I was in IoT before I took on this role, and I kind of get tired of saying IoT because it's kind of a cliche. I probably say it 75 times a day, give or take. But it's in the mass market. It has arrived, and it's having a tremendous impact in terms of what the supply chain looks like from a global standpoint today. And of course, you know, we're definitely in a kind of a market correction right now, electronics-wise, in the sense that we're seeing some supply chain imbalances that are correcting themselves around the world. I suspect that as organizations in the electronics world, you've seen some type of kind of similar type of dynamics in your businesses as well. Now, there are some really interesting technology trends that are going to drive our business in the very short term. So like I said, today we're in relatively, you know, a dull market, to say the least. But there are kind of three main things that we're watching. So first of all, 5G is going to change the dynamic of our business in the very short term. Now, I'm not going to stand here and give you a lesson in terms of why 5G is relevant. I'm sure, of course, you've all heard about it. But the main reason why people are pretty pumped up about 5G is the fact that it allows a whole new generation of applications to reside in cellular. So I'm sure some of you at some point in your past have been in a stadium or some type of large public environment. You've had 5 bars in your phone, and you can't send a text. Anybody experienced that before? Yeah, a couple nods at that, right? And it usually happens when you got to contact your wife for certain, right? But you can't get a hold of her. That's because, you know, current technology only allows a certain number of connections per tower. What 5G allows is 1 million connections per square kilometer. And so all of a sudden, a whole bunch of new applications that in the past, you know, you couldn't have on cellular for latency reasons or speed reasons, like, you know, life critical, autonomous vehicle, etc., can now reside on cell. Now, you're asking me why I'm bringing this up. As we build out infrastructure around the world for 5G, this is going to have a pretty significant impact on the overall supply chain, right? In terms of high-end microprocessors, all the way down to capacitors, discrete semiconductors, all the things that I suspect have caused you headaches at some point over the last little while. So 5G is coming. We expect that 2020 is what, you know, it will drive growth in our business overall. And then right behind that will be a whole set of applications, like I mentioned, that will reside on cellular for the first time. And so expect some really interesting kind of industry dynamics as a result of 5G. Now, automotive is the next thing. We track automotive pretty closely. And even though automotive sales globally are down in some regions or flat, you know, the electrification and the electronification of automotive is absolutely going to have an impact on your lives, both from an obsolescence standpoint as well as a supply chain availability standpoint. I'll talk about both. Obsolescence-wise, actually, I'll start with supply chain. I had a conversation with I know there are a few suppliers in the room, so I'll be careful with how I phrase these things. I had a conversation with a supplier recently in the automotive world on the semiconductor side, and I was asking them about, you know, what will be the impact of these various dynamics on the supply chain. And his point was that if electronification happens and electrification happens the way they think it will be, there's not enough capacity on the planet today to satisfy the needs of automotive, let alone everything else. Now, this is anecdotal, so I'm sure there's some research that needs to be done. But the interesting thing is that this thing picks up, it's going to put a lot of pressure on the supply chain overall. Now, what's interesting is that you'll see there are certain suppliers, again, I can't say who they are, who are investing in some pretty significant capacity to make sure they meet this. But this is coming, so you have to be aware of this. And then from an obsolescence standpoint, you know, as suppliers have only certain amounts of capacity in their supply chains to build things themselves, they'll have to make some hard decisions, right, in terms of what they build. So if BMW comes to one of our suppliers asking for, you know, trillions of pieces of a certain devices, they're making calls in terms of what it is they're going to build in the future, which will impact people in this room. And then finally, artificial intelligence. I think that was mentioned earlier today. AI is pretty interesting. I mean, when you get past all the kind of social, kind of political dynamics of it, you know, it will have an impact on the supply chain in the sense that a whole new set of suppliers that maybe you've never heard of will all of a sudden play a pretty big role in your businesses. Because I suspect that all of you, or if not some of you, you know, your engineering departments are thinking about how they can use AI to further their business or your business. And as a result, you'll have to engage with a whole bunch of different suppliers who perhaps you don't know that well and perhaps don't have the maturity of the suppliers that you're kind of used to dealing with. And then finally, you know, I want to talk about customers a little bit too, because what you're, you know, we realize that your needs are changing as well. And as new technology comes into play, as your supply chains become more and more global, you need transparency, right? And as a result, we know there are challenges that you're dealing with there. So that's what we see is kind of happening in the broader market. And if you have questions at the end, I think I can take some there. But this is kind of a, you know, it's a pretty complex technology, you know, overall story. Now, this is where we are today. I mean, obviously, the economy is slowing. And of course, you all read the headlines. And the interesting thing is that we're in a very uncertain environment with regard to, you know, what we expect is going to happen in the short term. Now, we as a company, Aero, you know, we track all of these kind of indicators on a regular basis to kind of get a sense for, you know, what we're going to see in the market in the short term. And it has all kinds of impacts in terms of, you know, how much inventory we have, how we resource our company, and how our, you know, what our customers are going to see in the short term. And as you can see here from the different colors, you know, there are some really, you know, interesting dynamics out there. You know, consumer sentiment is mixed overall. You know, GDP is starting to be forecasted down a little bit. Automotive sales are no longer growing. Industrial production indexes are down. Payrolls are down, et cetera. And so we think that in the very short term, you know, we're entering into some type of really interesting dynamic, you know, from an industry standpoint. Now, but what's kind of interesting is that if you look at the bottom right corner, you'll see that starting now, you know, semiconductor consumption is starting to pick up a little bit as well. Now, I bring this up because of this. Now, I am not an economist. I don't know if there are any economists in the room. If there are, please don't correct me if I'm wrong, because there's a good chance that I am wrong. But we, you know, this is what you're looking at here, and don't try and make sense of it, is the historical trend of 10-year Treasury bill yields. And when T-bills, so those of you who follow this stuff, you know, when the Treasury bill yield goes into the negative, it means that people expect that interest rates will be lower in the near term, right? And they think that interest rates are lower in the near term because central governments will be trying to, you know, accelerate their overall economies by giving low interest rates. And it's usually a precursor to a recession. Now, recently, we went into negative territory. Now, we came out of it, by the way, but we're still bouncing along this kind of zero. And as you see, every single recession since 1980 has been precursed by one of these type of events. And so as a result, we think that, you know, we're going to have some type of recessionary event in the very near term. Now, you're asking me why I'm bringing that up. We're already in a recession from an electronics standpoint. And so back in, I'm not sure if you followed this, but, you know, we're actually in the steepest downturn since 1981 from an electronics standpoint today. And while, you know, that's, it really depends on your perspective, right? If you're on the supplier side of our business, it's not a good time. If you're on the purchasing side, maybe not so bad, right? Because all of a sudden your lead times have gone down significantly. So it really depends on your perspective. But overall, there are impacts on everybody in this room when consumption goes down. Now, I'm sure someone's thinking, you know, asking why does this happen. I'll give you a quick anecdote. So back in January, I'm not sure if you recall, but Apple reduced their overall sales demand or sales forecast from, I think it was $94 billion for the first quarter to $86 billion. So pretty big numbers. Now, what that meant, most of you are with manufacturers, I believe. And so you know that, you know, the difference is sales at $8 billion that Apple went down. And you know that of that $8 billion, I mean, I think their gross profit as a company is roughly 40%, give or take. So call that $5 billion of cost of goods sold. And you know that when you're building a thing, you know, roughly 70 to 80% of the cost of that thing is in materials, right? Components, PCBs, packaging, whatever it happens to be. Now, it could be 90, it could be 60, but the point is it's the larger percentage overall, right? And so that $5 billion of COGS, cost of goods sold decline, equated to roughly $4 billion of things that Apple would buy, most of which obviously is electronics. And that was all driven by, you know, reduced, you know, customer demand for handsets in China, et cetera, et cetera. Now, to give you some context, that means $4 billion of demand came out of the global supply chain for electronics overnight. $4 billion. Now, the equivalent of that is that if every single customer that Arrow has in the Americas closed today times four. So all of a sudden, this massive glut of inventory quickly became available. And lead times on things like embedded processors, you know, high-end analog devices, all the way down to capacitors and resistors, et cetera, went from what had been 26 to 52 weeks down to 12 weeks or 8 weeks or 4 weeks instantaneously. So you can imagine there's a pretty significant impact, you know, with regard to, you know, how customers consumed. And what was interesting was at the same time, you know, people like you had been building up inventory because lead times were so long. And now we're in this environment. So this is actually, like I said, the steepest decline. Now what you're seeing is that this slide, you don't, the numbers are not really relevant. Just look at the blue line. That's peak consumption in the Americas from a semiconductor standpoint, starting in September of 18. And so roughly, you know, we consumed about $11 billion of devices in that month. Now we're down to $5 billion a month, give or take. And so the decline has been pretty significant. Now, what that means is, from a supplier standpoint, is A, they stopped staging as much inventory because they have pretty big, you know, piles of inventory on their, you know, in their docks overall. And they start to focus on other things as a company, i.e., you know, maximizing profit in the short term. Because all of a sudden, the sales they expected evaporate. I would say evaporate's maybe the wrong word, but they decline significantly and quickly. And so as a result, lead times come down. Now, what we expect is going to happen in the short term is that lead times will start to slowly inch up as our suppliers have been taking out capacity in terms of their manufacturing. Now, so this is kind of, so you asked me here, so why do I put, can you go back one? Ah, good. So why is this relevant, right? Market comes down, and this is what happened to lead times. Now, what you're seeing here is kind of an overall kind of lead time story since I think it was May of 2015 by Commodity and Semiconductor. And I could put up, you know, all kinds of different slides around different technologies overall. But this just kind of gives you a sense. And the interesting thing is that, you know, I think I presented this slide recently and I had a question in terms of, well, how can I protect myself against this? And, you know, I would argue that, you know, people like Converge exist to protect you against things like this. And people like Arrow exist to protect you against things like this. But this is, you know, these are just lead times that change over time. And the big gray line is the one that I want to probably point out. And this is, you know, discrete semiconductor. This is the golden screw, as it were. And I'm sure everybody in this room is nodding to a certain extent because you've seen, you know, similar types of shortages. But, you know, this is why companies like us are around, to protect you from situations like this. And the question would be, you know, well, how can I protect myself? And the question is, and the answer is always, you know, give us as much visibility as you can overall in terms of your supply chains and what you need kind of into the future. Okay. Let's move on to the future, speaking of which. So this is what we expect. Now, I'll say this. This is actually kind of funny. So my next job, I swear to God, is going to be an industry prognosticator that you're seeing here. Because as late as July, half of these companies still projected growth for 2019. And then when they realized that the market was shrinking, they changed their forecast to negative. And apparently that's okay. So that's my next job, is I'm going to be a dice roller at IC Insights. But overall, you can see that across the overall business of the Americas, you know, we're seeing significant declines across the board. And again, driven primarily by glut of inventory, driven primarily by, you know, economic uncertainty from tariffs, and driven primarily by, you know, who knows what happens next in terms of the global economy. But we do expect that coming into the early part of next year, driven by those factors I talked about, you know, 5G, automotive, AI, and then general kind of industry kind of inventory bleed down, that we'll see some growth overall. What we expect to see now, so I'll put it this way, is that, you know, we track certain technologies that are, we think they're bellwethers. You know, memory, spot prices on DRAM is one, passive components are another. And we're starting to see some type of indication that the market is starting to pick up. So spot prices for DRAM, I get a daily report on this, are now up for the first time in a long time. And companies like Micron are starting to talk about, you know, shortages, you know, in their overall demand, extending lead times, et cetera. Now, it's possible that they're trying to pump the market to a certain extent. But, you know, I'll leave that to somebody else to decide. But we think there are some trends that are happening. Passive components, lead times are starting to tighten a little bit with regard to those things. So perhaps start to prepare yourself now, you know, for what could be, you know, an interesting early part of 2020. And so across, you know, at WSTS, Mike Cowan and Semiconductor Industry Association all see some growth for early next year. We think primarily driven by memory. We think it'll start in Asia, which will happen in the early part of 2020. We think America's picks up in a significant way in the back half of the year, of the calendar year, kind of overall. So, okay, that's I am almost out of time. So I, you know, I'm really happy to answer questions. You know, there are a lot of kind of interesting dynamics around our business. It's pretty complex, obviously. So let's perhaps move to questions, if we could. I'm not done yet. I'm still here. Not to clap.
That's awesome. We got a few more minutes to do this. So I'm going to read a couple of questions, and he's going to give a great answers, and then you guys are going to have the opportunity to question Jake as well. So here we go. First question is, what new challenges on the supply chain end do you foresee in the future of obsolescence management?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, I'll go to the next
no,
question.
I'm kidding. No, so it's, you know, this is, where is Michael, by the way? Okay, so I'm gonna put you in the spot after I'm done answering to make sure I've answered your question, because it was, I felt the question, you know, it's a very broad question, right? I could probably answer it a bunch of ways, but the way I think I plan to answer it is kind of in two ways from a, you know, from a semiconductor manufacturer perspective. And so number one, industry consolidation obviously plays a pretty significant role in this area. And we've seen waves of consolidation overall. I mean, if you go back 5 years ago to today, the number of players, you know, in the industry overall has changed significantly. It's reduced significantly. We saw a wave of consolidation about 2 years ago as some pretty big companies bought some other pretty big companies. And what usually follows is some type of, you know, again, by the way, it really depends on who the acquirer is and who's being bought. Because a lot of our suppliers have very clear stated policies around product longevity, et cetera, et cetera. But usually, there's some type of end-of-life activity. We haven't seen a lot for the last couple of years because primarily the market has been super hot, right? I mean, the you know, market, I mean the stock market. And so as a result, you know, organizations have been extremely expensive to purchase. Now, I'll give you a recent example. The one that we're going through right now is, you know, Infineon, you know, a German company, bought Cypress Semiconductor, an American company, for, I think it was $10 billion. And to give you some context, Cypress is a $2 billion company, so a 5x sales, which is a pretty big number. So that was the first of the big ones that happened again. Now, we expect that, you know, there are fewer and fewer of those deals that can happen, but we think that we're starting to enter another period of consolidation and acquisition. And, you know, I will not speculate on behalf of the organization with, you know, who we think is next just because of the audience. But we know that there are, we don't know anything, but we think there are a lot more coming. And what happens there is, you know, obsolescence of components. The other thing that we've seen recently from an obsolescence standpoint is that, you know, when the market is down, you know, a lot of organizations, in an attempt to boost their sales or operating income or whatever it happens to be, will obsolete older devices. Now, you know, that's my opinion. But we've seen activity around companies like Xilinx, companies like Altera, you know, Intel PSG, they're called now, NXP, et cetera, who will take older product lines and drive a short-term sales action around obsolescence of older devices. I think my next question here will kind of answer what you can do to protect yourself, but it's kind of a tough one, right? Because in a lot of cases, you know, you're locked, you know, these are usually pretty high-end devices, and you're kind of locked in from a technology perspective. And so my advice there is to make sure that your design departments are ensuring that they're designing with newer stuff as opposed to older stuff. I think that'd be my answer. Was that what you're looking for, generally speaking? Okay, cool.
Passing grade? All right, very good. Next question. How is design engineering working to mitigate obsolescence issues, and what tools or information can the supply chain provide to help? Hear from Matt Voigt.
Right. So where is Matt? Okay, cool. So I assume you're asking me what it is that what your own internal design groups are doing to mitigate? Yeah? Okay, cool. So what my history, I think I can speak intelligently to this, or semi-intelligently. So I, Arrow for 20 years, but 15 of my 20 years were spent in the field, you know, running a business. And so I've spent a lot of time with customers. And the kind of the dynamic that I've seen over time has been kind of this tension between, you know, designers and materials planning departments, and how, you know, design departments are choosing the best thing for them, but not always the best thing for the business, if that makes sense. And so I'll put it this way. If you go back 10 years ago, and I'm sure I'll get these numbers wrong, but if you go back 10 years ago, the number of orderable part numbers, even 15 years ago, orderable part numbers available on the planet was like 250,000 parts, right? And as a result, you know, it was easier to get things. If you fast forward, you know, 10 years, I think the number of SKUs that exist on the planet now is something like 2.5 billion part numbers, right? Because and the reason for that is very planned, in the sense that, you know, organizations don't like being designed out of applications or being commoditized or being swapped out or whatever it is. And I'm sure every person in this room, as you're doing designs or as you're building products, you know, you want to have as much kind of, you know, dual source, triple source components, so that when you get into trouble on something, you can just swap somebody else in. That is, you know, in a lot of cases, it doesn't work, you know, for people who make those devices. You know, they want to have as many situations where you're captive to a certain extent, and so they make devices as sole source as possible, especially on the higher end MCU, microprocessors, FPGAs, signal chain, etc. And so I've seen this natural tension, again, back to my earlier point, where engineers are picking the best part that they see, right? But that part might not be available. And then the poor purchaser has to deal with that problem when you try to build these things. And so for me, this question is more of an internal thing in terms of what, you know, how do you manage your business internally? And so the best practices that I've seen, I mean, you're sitting by Diane here. I mean, Schweitzer is probably one of the best practices where, you know, the engineering departments and the early sourcing departments are as close, right, as we see in the industry. And across customers that I've called on over my life, it's always about, you know, communication internally, you know, having cross-functional teams around new designs, et cetera. And while that sounds simplistic, I'm always really surprised how few organizations kind of have that discipline internally, because I can't explain it. It's a really interesting dynamic. So did I answer your question? Cool. All right. Okay, what else?
All right, now we can open up to the audience. Let's raise some hands if you have a question. Don't be shy. Nobody's shy at FOM.
Yeah, I can't sit down until you get another question.
There you go. You see anybody out there? There we go, right here.
Great.
Can we hold on for your mic there? That's a heck of a mic.
You mentioned IT. I'm sorry, AI. How that's going to affect... are you simply saying that AI is going to spur a growth in building a manufacturing of equipment to support AI, and
yeah,
so then will affect the...
So the AI thing, what I was trying to convey there was that, you know, IoT was first, right? In the sense that, you know, every company in here, and arguably every company on the planet, and I'll back up, you know, IoT is just connectivity, right? It's collecting real-world data, analyzing it to drive some type of business outcome. It's no more complex than that. The technology's been around for 30 years. It's just that some marketing genius coined IoT and it became the rage. Every company here went through figuring out how they could collect that real-world data to change their business, whether it was, you know, creating new streams of revenue, whether it was improving operations internally, or whatever the reason was that you wanted to collect that data. And we saw a whole generation of organizations who had not used technology in the past try and use technology to change their business. And they kind of bought into the hype. And in a lot of cases, most of these companies didn't have the internal capability to actually deploy these technologies overall. And it caused a lot of heartache at a lot of customers. And Frank, you probably have experienced that yourself. My AI comment was more kind of the next step in that. And so, you know, I watch television, you watch television, you see the IBM commercials of how, you know, we're collecting data and we're using AI to, you know, cure sicknesses in Africa. Whatever it is, there's all these kind of interesting use cases for it. And so my point was more that every organization on the planet, in my view, is either thinking about or will soon start thinking about how they can use artificial intelligence to change their business, for better or for worse. And what that is going to do is it's going to drive your organizations into dealing with a whole new set of suppliers that you've not historically dealt with, right? And those suppliers come with risk, right? And so, you know, I think Microchip and onsemi are in the room. And these are two long-term trusted brands in the industry who are known for quality and dependability, right? And you've built a business on them, for example, and the next thing you know, your CTO says, hey, we're going to put AI in place in our new products or whatever it happens to be. And now you're dealing with, you know, supplier XYZ who you don't know of. They may be 5 years old. And you're taking on a significant amount of risk in your supply chain as a result. That was kind of my point around AI. Okay?
Here we go. We got one more question. We're a little over time, but it's okay.
From the supply chain perspective,
yeah,
what do you see as the impact due to 5G? And second, when will 5G peak?
Peak? Okay. You know, I'll start backwards. So we feel that kind of the initial kind of growth from 5G will come in late 2020. And the reason, and that's an America's comment, because, you know, there are other parts of the world, like, you know, China obviously is well ahead of America in terms of deployment of the networks. Verizon and AT&T today have some cities that are under test, but when you think about it, you know, to deploy an entire, because by the way, every other cellular technology that's come before this has been more of like a software change, like an iteration to existing infrastructure, whereas 5G is a whole new deployment of new base stations, like all the towers that you see, they'll have new receivers and all those things. So we expect that to accelerate in the back half of 2020 with peak in 2021. And so if you think about it, you know, building out national networks of, you know, cell towers, for example, will take up a lot of high-end components. So FPGA would be, so field programmable gate arrays. So if you're using Xilinx or Intel PSG, there's an impact there. And then you'll also see an impact from microprocessors and then some high-performance analog from, say, analog devices, Maxim, et cetera. And so those are probably the main things you should watch for. But there's a knock-on effect, too, because, you know, every one of these components, every one of these boxes, rather, is full of capacitors and discrete semiconductors and all the things that everybody on the planet uses, right? And so that's what we think from an overall peak standpoint. But it'll depend on certain factors around, you know, market acceptance and all that kind of stuff. So really just kind of pay attention to the marketing, right? And as AT&T, Verizon, and other carriers start making more noise about, you know, when their networks are available. And this is not like you've seen the AT&T, the 5G commercials. That's not really 5G. It's actually 5GE evolution, which means it's really 4G. But when they start talking about true 5G marketing, that's when you should be paying attention to the supply chain overall. And what was your, I think I answered both parts of your question there, right?
Somewhat.
What was the first part of your question? I forget.
First part of the question was,
Mm-hmm.
Went down to smaller packaging, but what actually happened is the larger packaging was impacted because Murata, TDK, for instance, started dropping out of the market in those particular packages.
Yep.
Which then made them harder to get, plus allocation.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't expect an allocation market that will flow from 5G. I expect that, 5G will drive growth in the market overall and will drive some lengthening lead times. But, if you look at, that event that you're referring to on the passive side of things was really pretty remarkable. And in fairness, Murata, Yagio, and guys had given the market 3 years of warning. Right, to get out of the smaller or the larger case sizes, but no one did anything about it, which I found really interesting. Now, some other suppliers like Chemet, AVX, et cetera, have built up capacity on the larger case sizes, but, 5G will, I don't see the demand being such. What you got to watch for there from an allocation standpoint is when automotive sales start to grow again, or if handset, like the new iPhones have some like 2,000 capacitors per phone, right? So that's the kind of thing that you have to watch for. Not so much 5G. All right.
All right, I got to get